Rainforests are often cut down and coral reefs are overfished by poor people who are struggling to get by. There are hundreds of aid projects around the world that try to protect these habitats. The idea is to create other methods for the poor to make money. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, a young scientist traveled to the Central Pacific to investigate whether these programs work, and she was shocked at what she found.
The island nation of Kiribati has a very simple economy. People either catch fish or they pick coconuts from their trees and produce coconut oil.
Most people have a little bit of land and they have access to the coral reefs, and so they should easily be able to switch between the two, and they do, actually.
Sheila Walsh is a postdoctoral researcher at Brown University. She says the government of Kiribati had a program that was designed to protect the fish on the reef by subsidizing the local coconut industry.
The thought was that by paying people more to do coconut agriculture, they would do less fishing, and that this would fulfill two goals. One, they would reduce overfishing, and two, that people would be better off. They'd have higher incomes.
Walsh wanted to know whether this plan was working, and the government said, go ahead, find out. So, as part of her graduate studies at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, she flew to Kiribati to interview fishermen.
And it turned out that actually the result of paying people more to do coconut agriculture was actually to increase fishing.
How could that be?
Right. It was a bit of a surprise, and we were wondering what's going on here.
The answer was simplicity itself. Her study concludes that people earned more money making coconut oil, which meant that they could work less to support themselves. And they spent their new leisure time fishing.
It hit us like a bumper sticker saying, you know, a bad day fishing is better than a good day of working, and I think that's sort of the story here.
The impact on the reef was distressing. The fish population had dropped to even lower levels, putting the whole ecosystem at risk. It turns out that Walsh had stumbled into a universal truth about fishing. Fishermen aren't just in it for the money. Anthropologist Richard Polnack at the University of Rhode Island says, just think of those snazzy sport fishing excursions.
People pay big money to go sports fishing.
Fishing as an occupation provides psychic benefits as well as money. Polnick argues not just individuals, but whole cultures get hooked on the thrill of being out on the water and the gamble of coming back with either a boatload or empty-handed.
This type of an occupation selects for a certain type of personality, and that personality type will not be happy in many other occupations other than fishing.
As a result, attempts to get fishermen to do something else, even something that pays better, often end in failure, Polnack says.
There have been projects where they had vessel buyback programs, and almost 50% of the fishermen used that money to buy another boat and do another type of fishing, and in some cases get right back into fishing.
The track record for international projects is poorly studied, which makes Sheila Walsh's research notable. Polnack says he can't point to any real successes.
A great deal of the international development money, I would argue, is basically wasted.
This problem is not lost on Craig Lesher at the Nature Conservancy. His organization does spend money to help fishermen seek other livelihoods, but does it keep them out of their boats?
Well, no. It doesn't work to get them off the water, rarely.
So he says the Nature Conservancy funds non-fishing jobs as a tactic to help during a transition. For example, fishermen may need a temporary source of income when a new no-fishing zone is established. Fishermen lose their fishing income for a while until the regional fish population recovers.
What we have found with our research is that a lot of alternative income activities are not successful in the long term. So what we do is just look for activities that can benefit communities just in the near term, the next 2 or 3 years.
Which brings us back to the island nation of Kiribati. Sheila Walsh says the government there is now trying to figure out how to fix the problem of overfishing, which it had accidentally made worse. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Now to some of the latest medical advances in restoring eyesight. Millions of people in the U.S. have lost the ability to see from diseases that attack the retina. Now scientists say they have brought back some vision in people with retinal damage. One team did it using stem cells, another using electronics. NPR's John Hamilton has this story on research by both of those teams. It was presented in Chicago today at the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience.
Doctors have gotten pretty good at fixing problems with the cornea, where light enters the eye, and they're experts at replacing the lens, which focuses that light. But it's a different story with the retina, a layer of cells at the back of the eye that transforms images of the world into nerve impulses. Robert Aramont of the University of California, Irvine, says a patient with retinal damage doesn't have many options.
That is so terrible. A doctor can only say that you will probably be more and more blind, and you might be totally blind in 10, 15 years.
Since the 1980s, Aramont has been part of a team working to fix retinas damaged by diseases including macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa. And for several years now, the team has been treating patients using fetal retinal cells. Their approach is to retrieve an intact sheet of retinal cells and transplant that sheet into a damaged eye.
And these cells develop later on to the layers of a normal retina.
Aramont says they've treated just 10 patients so far because of funding constraints. But he says 7 of those patients got better, including one woman whose vision went from 2800, which is nearly blind, to 2200, which is good enough to do most daily tasks.
And she improved her life considerably. She just could play a computer game, and she could write emails. She could write big letters of Reader's Digest. And she took up her hobby to paint ceramics.
A very different approach to restoring vision comes from scientists at a California firm called Second Sight Medical Products. Brian Meck, a vice president with a PhD in materials science, says the company has created a sort of bionic eye.
The subject wears a pair of glasses that has a video camera in them, and then we wirelessly transmit the video signal to an implant that sits on the eye. And that implant then talks to an array of electrodes that are inside the eye on the retina.
Those electrodes do what the old retina can't anymore, send electrical signals to the brain that allow sight. You can see an animation of how the device works at npr.org. Meck says it usually takes patients' brains a while to make sense of the new signals.
They learn to use the device better over time, so that someone that's had it for a year will do better than they did at 3 months.
The artificial eye replaces millions of retinal cells with just 60 electrodes. Meck says that means vision is rudimentary.
A very large percentage of people can find doors and move towards them, and a similarly large number can follow a line on a floor.
Meck says patients tend to get emotional when they realize they can see even a little bit.
A lot of crying, a lot of smiling, you know, it's a sensory input that they haven't had in a very long time, and so they're excited.
At the neuroscience meeting in Chicago, Second Sight presented a study showing that patients could tell which direction an object was moving. Also at the meeting, scientists presented studies showing ways to create new light-sensitive molecules in the eye and how to use stem cells to grow specific types of retinal cells. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum unveiled a new display featuring an important artifact. It's a camera that spent over 15 years in space. It was inside the Hubble telescope, taking astoundingly beautiful images of celestial objects. Hubble started out as a national disgrace, but as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, this camera turned Hubble into a triumph.
The Hubble Space Telescope is still whizzing around the planet, but at the Air and Space Museum, you can see a full-scale model, and now, below it, is a display case. It holds something that looks a little like a black baby grand piano. This is the Wide Field and Planetary Camera 2. Earlier today, Ed Weiler saw it for the first time since 1993.
It was like seeing a long-lost brother or sister.
So is it fair to say that you love this thing?
Love is a many-dimensioned word. Let's put it this way. Without this thing, my career would have gone a very different direction, to say the least.
Ed Weiler is now head of NASA's Science Mission Directorate. Back in 1990, he was chief scientist for Hubble when NASA launched the telescope and made a sickening discovery. The main mirror had a flaw. The images were fuzzy. This Hubble trouble made the telescope a laughingstock.
You know, it was an intense period. I mean, we went from the top of Mount Everest at launch to the bottom of Death Valley a month later.
But Weiler says his team had hope. They'd already started constructing a backup camera. they decided to compensate for Hubble's problem by changing four little tiny mirrors the size of nickels in this replacement camera. In 1993, astronauts took it up.
The first picture came back from this, and it was perfect. It was fixed. And that was just a cathartic moment that I put up there with the birth of my two children, as I'll never forget.
The astronauts also installed a set of corrective optics called COSTAR for other instruments. That's now on display, too. But Weiler says iconic images, like the famous Pillars of Creation, came from this camera.
So in terms of our connection to the public, this is the camera that saved Hubble.
The camera returned to Earth in May after astronauts removed it so they could install a newer version. David Dvorkin is a curator at the museum. He says this camera deserves to be enshrined here for our descendants.
They will look at this and say, well, in the late 20th century, we devoted an enormous amount of very, very high talent and resources to learning more about the universe.
He'd love to put the actual Hubble telescope right next to it.
We're very, very happy to accept it if NASA decides to bring it home.
But with the space shuttles supposed to be retired next year, that is not likely. After Hubble's instruments break in 5 to 10 years, it's expected to be sent down to burn in the atmosphere, with debris crashing into the Pacific. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
We're going to give you the dirt on dust. Even the most well-scrubbed homes will have some dust build up somewhere. And the reason to remove dust is not just aesthetic. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, dust has some potentially harmful stuff in it.
As they used to say in Elizabethan times, how dost thou? I tend to favor a vacuum. On the other hand, nature abhors a vacuum. But before we get into removing dust, let's talk a bit about what dust is and how it gets into your house.
Outdoor soil particles that come in on your shoes.
Paloma Beamer is on the faculty of the University of Arizona in Tucson and something of a dustologist. Outdoor soil is one element in dust. Another is the tiny particles in air that float in when you open a window or door. And then there's the indoor component of dust.
Like pieces of your carpet fiber or your furniture, your bedding, or anything like that that starts decaying.
The indoor components also include certain bits of organic matter.
A lot of our skin flakes and dander off your pets and other insects or bugs that might be in the home.
Now, as anyone who's looked under a sofa knows, there's dense dust and there's fluffy dust.
So a lot of the fluffy things, I think, tend to do more when you get a lot of fibers. In my house, it comes from cat hair.
Beamer is interested in dust because it's one way people can be exposed to toxic substances. For example, for someone living near a toxic waste site, some of those chemicals can end up in house dust. The question is, how much? In a recent paper in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, she calculates the proportion of dust that's from indoor sources compared to outdoor.
The indoor percentage would be around 34%. And then the two-thirds from outdoor comes both from soil track-in and the outdoor air particles.
But to understand the potential for exposure, it's also crucial to understand how dust can get into your body. Turns out, for dust, size matters.
The big thing about particles and breathing particles is the size of those.
Andrea Ferro is also a dust expert. She's at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York. She says some of the particles are small enough that they can float in the air and we can breathe them into our lungs. Others are larger and tend to sink more rapidly to the ground. One thing that's remarkable about dust is that it sticks around. Ferro says without vacuuming, it can stick around for a long time.
And we're finding things like DDT in many indoor dust samples. Well, we haven't had, we banned that decades ago, but it's still there.
In addition to breathing in dust through your nose, you can also swallow it. Duke University's Heather Stapleton is an environmental chemist. She says you may not be in the habit of licking the floors or carpets in your home, but some younger members of your household might be doing essentially that.
Being a parent of a six-month-old, I can't tell you how many times I look at my son and I see him with his hands in the mouth all the time or picking up a toy and putting it in his mouth. So it's incredibly difficult to quantify what mass of dust they're actually exposed to and any contaminants associated with that dust, but it definitely occurs.
Stapleton says it's really hard to estimate just how much exposure a person has to the chemicals in dust. But obviously, reducing the amount of dust will reduce your exposure.
keeping a well-dusted home, a well-vacuumed home, will reduce the dust in your home the most.
Paloma Beamer says you want to get a good vacuum, and if it has one, change the bag before it gets too full.
And it's important to remind yourself to not just vacuum your floor, but also your upholstered furniture.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay, more work to do.
Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Dusting the globe. It's the extinction of giant animals that once roamed the Earth. Scientists do not know what killed off woolly mammoths and other animals after the last ice age. Maybe the climate changed, maybe a comet struck the Earth, maybe humans hunted them down. Now, a study out today in Science magazine examines some evidence the animals left behind. Here's NPR's Richard Harris.
After the end of the last ice age, North America was covered with large animals even more diverse than we see in Africa today.
We had, you know, the iconic mammoths and mastodons, but also beaver the size of black bear, you know, giant ground sloths. There were camels and horses in North America, which is often a surprise to many people. And then, of course, there are predators, right, like the American lion, the short-faced bear, the dire wolves, etc.
Jacqueline Gill is getting her PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's fascinated by how we came to have such diverse wildlife and why those animals are all gone today.
By about 11,000 years ago, we lose half of the animals in North America larger than the size of a German shepherd, and that's a pretty big ecological event.
There aren't enough bones left to figure out in detail when exactly they all went extinct, but Gill and her colleagues hit upon a nifty method to track the abundance of grazing animals. The scientists study, of all things, a certain species of fungus. Spores of the fungus end up in lake sediments that date back some 15,000 years.
So the spores from this fungus are preserved in the lake, and this fungus only grows on animal dung.
When there were lots of large animals, there was lots of dung. When the animals went away, so did the dung and the fungus that lived on those droppings. So, by studying the amount of this fungus in various layers of lake sediment, Gill and her group have pieced together a timetable that helps resolve how and when these animals died out. One of the long-held ideas had been that a climate shift caused a change in vegetation, and the new plant matter was no good for these grazing animals, so they starved. But no, Gill and company have disproved that by putting a date on the animal's decline. It was way back, more than 14,000 years ago.
And this happens before some of the widespread vegetation change that we see in the areas that we studied, which suggests to us that habitat loss is actually not a cause of the declines, but possibly a consequence.
That is, the vegetation might have changed after the browsing animals disappeared and stopped munching on it. The new dates also help eliminate other ideas that have been argued over the years. John Alroy at the University of California, Santa Barbara, says it's clear that the extinctions couldn't have been caused by a cold snap called the Younger Dryas.
These data show that the extinction happened well before that time. And there's also been a recent paper arguing that the extinction might have been caused by the impact of a comet. And that impact appears to have happened much, much later than the decline, at least at this location.
So what does that leave? Well, human beings were moving into North America at that time. So Alroy says this is more evidence that hunters played a key role in driving those large animals to extinction.
And now really the question is exactly what did humans do to cause this large extinction?
Jacqueline Gill at Madison is interested in that question too, because she notes human beings are now forcing another mass extinction as we reshape habitat around the world. Richard Harris, NPR News.